it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate, and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
I am Marquise Bay, and I am an assistant professor of African American Studies and English at Northwestern University. And the book we're going to be talking about today is my forthcoming book, Anarcho-Blackness, Notes Toward a Black Anarchism, coming out with AK Press.
Before we get into the questions that we had set up, just to start us off, why did you decide to write this book right now?
Yeah, so that actually came about when I was given a reading of my first book. I was in New York at the time. I was given a reading of my first book, and one of the people in the audience was actually a grad student at SUNY Cortland, and she asked me the question, because I was talking a lot about radical Black feminisms, and she asked me the question of why there weren't very many like self-proclaimed Black feminist anarchists, and I just had no answer to her, and that always frustrates me when I can't really answer a question. So essentially what I gave her was an elaborated I don't know, and because of that moment, and because of my frustration with not being able to answer her question in a way that was sufficient for me, I essentially just wrote this book. Like very much the day after I did that reading, I started looking into all of the anarchism literature that I could in order to try to answer that question for her. And the book is now my answer to that question. She actually literally just emailed me the other day, and I'm about to respond to her email saying that she saw the book come out. So yeah, that's where the book really came from, that question. And so I'm very much thankful to her for asking that question and for inspiring the book.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad she asked the question.
I am too.
So just to get into it, we're going to read just a couple of sections, and we're going to ask you to elaborate on them. At the start of the text, you write, quote, that anarchism of, say, Bakunin is no longer anarchism proper when it meets Blackness. Neither anarchism nor Blackness can be what it once was, which is itself an unsettled open question after colliding in a critical generative intimacy with one another. So I attempt here in this text to illustrate a facet of that intimacy. Can you get into that a little more about what you're talking about?
Of course. So the bringing together of Blackness and anarchism for me is not, it's not an additive gesture. It's not just that I'm giving anarchism a Black face or something like that. It's a qualitative or paradigmatic shift that, when they're brought together, they undergo a reconfiguration, and necessarily so. So when the two are brought together, it requires a different understanding of both, which means that they don't interact in an expected way, like Black people who are anarchists, for example. And I'm actually super bored by that move. It's not unvaluable, and it's been done to worthy effect by, for example, the Black Rose Anarchist Federation. But that's not the move that I want to make, simply naming all the Black people who are anarchists, like Lucy Parsons, Ashanti Austin, Lorenzo Irving, etc. And neither is my interest in simply pointing out the implicit racism or white solipsism of classical anarchists. So instead, my interest is in how the oversights in anarchism when it came to race, and specifically Blackness, in fact, constituted anarchism as anarchism, and how the oversights of the Black radical tradition in its disavowal of or overlooking of an affiliation with anarchism proper constituted the tradition. So in other words, how both anarchisms and the Black radical tradition's refusal to claim one another meant that they were each defined by way of the other's exclusion. So to include each with the other. It means that they can no longer be what they were, since what they were since what they were disallowed the inclusion of the other. And I'm interested in what that new thing is. And I think the new thing that they become, or what happens when they are not simply brought together, but shown how they have long inflected each other in their practices and beliefs. I think what comes of that is what I call in the book anarcho-blackness. And that's my analytic for thinking about the reconfigurative relationship with blackness and anarchism, and when they're brought together. And anarcho-blackness kind of stands in contrast, or in kind of tension, with someone like Carl Levy, who focuses on the ism of anarchism, that suffix, which defines anarchism as a social movement arising in a specific time and place and as a specific kind of organization and movement, etc. But for me, to focus on the anarcho, the prefix of anarchism, is to emphasize the spirit of anarchic tendencies and ways of relating. It's a focus on a world-making sensibility rather than a particular political cadre of writing and movement. So anarcho-blackness, which circulates within, but also against and in excess of an identifiable, maybe even classical black anarchism, does not dwell in delineating criteria for a discernible black anarchism as a movement, but concerns the modes and methodologies, thoughts and imaginaries that might be given to anarchic, which is to say unruled, non-coercive, coalitional, anarchic affinities and textures for being with others.
Yeah, that's a fabulous way to get started in this conversation. We'll be talking obviously a lot more about those points. But just to go on in the introduction to the book, you go on to write, blackness is itself an anarchic extension and disruption of political ideologies like anarchism and Marxism and socialism. I'm just curious if you can talk more about that idea of extension and disruption of those ideas.
Mm-hmm. I think about blackness not merely as skin color, but in terms of say black anarchist Ashanti Austin, who says that for him, blackness is an oppositional force or touchstone for looking at situations differently. And I'm also drawing on the more academic work of people like Hortense Spillers and Fred Moten and C. Riley Snorton for this recalibrated definition of blackness as, in short, tied to what's been called fugitivity. So by understanding it in that way, it means that in as much as classical anarchism or Marxism or socialism are tied to organizational movements, and to whatever extent they have rules and regulations for inclusion or exclusion, blackness would anarchize them in that it necessitates a different way of looking at or doing or being within those political ideologies and postures. Blackness's introduction would mean that we must then be attentive to the things that have been cast out and excluded or deemed improper subjects and people and ways of thinking. And in those things that have been cast out might lie what I'm understanding as the generative radicalization of these movements.
This is one of my favorite quotes. You write, "The history of blackness, in short, is a history of disruption towards freedom. How anarchic." And I'm just curious, you know, right now we're seeing, and a lot of people have been commenting on this, obviously, but whitewashing of the current rebellion, framing it around, you know, so-called peaceful protest or the articulation of a small set of demands. I'm just kind of curious how you would view this attempt by either liberals or a lot of the left to shift the narrative away from anarchic disruption during such a historical moment.
Yeah, so the attempt to push toward peaceful and nonviolent protests and to highlight those aspects and denigrate other less peaceful aspects and demands is, to me, deeply embedded in an uncritical relation to or understanding of the state. And because to me, the primary source of violence in the world is the state itself. Yet liberals and neoliberals who charge protesters and rioters and rebels with the scarlet letter of violent and imply that makes the cause unworthy fail to consider the vast harm of state-imposed and state-orchestrated poverty or houselessness as themselves violent, or the declaration of war, domestic and international, as violent, or colonial and imperial conquest, environmental extraction and exploitation, privatized property and incarceration. All these things are violent and are perpetuated by the state. And if they were, if the liberals and those folks on the left who are making these critiques, if they were truly concerned about peace and nonviolence, their attention, in my estimation, would and ought to be devoted toward the state and capitalism and white supremacy and the gender binary. And they would also never shut up, because this kind of violence is constant and pervasive. And also, I think it needs to be noted how those communities, largely of color, have been living amidst all this violence and peacelessness for years. And yet we only see uprising after all the numerous, what liberals would surely call peaceful protests are when they're wholly ignored. So all the teddy bear memorials and tears and public grieving and letters and phone calls to state official and law enforcement. And there's another massive perpetrator of violence, law enforcement. All those phone calls are appeals to the state. And go entirely unanswered or delayed. So it strikes me that the protests now are evidence of a profound restraint. And it took, because it took this long, for there to be an uprising, but let the suburban dad be stuck in traffic because Black Lives Matter protesters are blocking the highway, and you'll see how little restraint the very people calling for quote unquote peaceful protests have when they are simply inconvenienced. So this is all to say that attempts to shift the narrative away from anarchic disruption and what is called violence is by and large an attempt, in my opinion, to preserve the state and hegemony, and nothing less than that.
Yeah, it's also interesting, or with Portland, where there's a focus suddenly on the violence against some demonstrators, when it suddenly becomes largely like suburban moms or veterans or something like that.
Yeah,
I know there's an interesting piece on Mike.com, actually, about Black anarchists and their role in the current rebellion, which I encourage people to read. But also just kind of the a lot of liberals have also taken out of the discussion kind of the role or the fact that lots of people are involved in these uprisings. Yes. And just kind of like totally just kind of tried to make them just peaceful demonstrations. It's a lot like I remember the discussion around like the Egyptian uprising in Tahrir Square, where they were painted out as like, you know, totally peaceful demonstrations, which of course was not true.
Yep, exactly.
You go on to write, I am unsure if I would call myself an anarchist, nor am I certain that I care about whether others do so. Perhaps I am, the consequence of which I own. But my concern is in doing anarchic work. And I think this bears the question, is the label of anarchist even important, or must we find perhaps a new label? You know, others have talked about using autonomous, which of course has its own history, or even anti-authoritarian. And I guess this also asks another question, is how does anarchism then relate to other anarchic movements, currents, forms of life, historical experiments and stuff like that?
Yeah, so I actually very distinctly remember writing those sentences, because I remember how insistent I used to be many years ago, or maybe not that many years ago, on people claiming labels that were historically maligned or marginalized or disparaged. But that often led me to be uninterested in the person or the work that they did once I got the affirmation of the label. And that to me is the issue. Like it would be nice for people to call themselves anarchists and not be afraid of doing so. It maybe give anarchism a kind of visibility that might help it become more widespread. But ultimately, I don't care all that much, because I'm concerned with doing and proliferating anarchic work. The work that is done by doing anarchism relative to the work done by declaring oneself anarchist is much greater. So that is where my concern is. I'm not saying one can call themselves whatever they want, or that what we call ourselves does not matter. What I'm saying is what we call ourselves bears little on, or much less on, what kind of work we do. And it is in the work where much of the change will come, I think. And in committing to the work, we open up space for others who might want to commit to that work or similar work, but who might call themselves something different for whatever reason. And if the work is the point at which we struggle, at which we struggle with one another, how people get there or what they call themselves before they get there becomes secondary to the fact that they're there doing the work. And that is my concern. And also why I prefer the prefixal anarcho rather than the suffix of the ism, because in the anarcho is the work in the mood, in the kind of tenor and texture, not the name or label of the ism.
Growing off of that question, in the last decade or so and beyond, there's been a real push to expand kind of our global knowledge of the history of anarchism, but also just the various currents and movements that were either autonomous or anti-state throughout history, anarchic either struggles or movements or events in history. But to put it simply, can anarchism itself be saved from whiteness? Is it possible to view anarchism as a worldwide movement, or is it forever locked kind of within the trappings of just being associated with white workers, you know, from like the late 1800s to the mid 19th century?
Yeah, this is a very, very legitimate concern and question. But I genuinely believe it can be saved from whiteness. And the writing of the book, I think, is a testament to my belief in that. Because whiteness cannot own anarchism, nor can anarchism be owned itself, because it rejects the very notion of covetously owned property. Anarchism, to me, has its roots in globality and away from whiteness. In fact, anarchism, in many ways, attempts to reject some of the functions of whiteness in its undermining of capitalism, constitutive of which is white supremacy. So if anarchism is to actualize its claims of anti-authoritarianism and the eradication of hierarchies, it must in fact exceed and reject notions of whiteness. And also, I think anarchism has its hand in a variety of other places and cultures that are not beholden to a kind of Eurocentric or Western conception of racialized identity. So, for example, in indigenous communities that mark a non-hierarchical and non-territorial relationship to the earth, or in African communalisms as detailed in Sam Baugh's book, African Anarchism. And also, I think historically in Maroon communities inhabited by fugitive slaves. So there's a long and wide history and contemporary of anarchic work being done that may not be called anarchism or recognized as anarchism, but nonetheless expresses the spirit of what I'm calling the anarcho. So anarchism deeply includes, and I want to be clear about this, it deeply includes white workers of the 18th and 19th centuries and all workers of the contemporary moment too. And anarcho-syndicalists like the famous Noam Chomsky make this quite clear, but that to me is only one facet of anarchism, and anarchism must be understood as bearing on how we relate to and think about non-workers and care work, which is overwhelmingly done by non-cis men, and how we reconceptualize what we consider work, or how we do life in excess of work by living and loving with others, because anarchism is present in these ways too, and those are the ways that I find, say, Black feminism to be useful. Black feminism to me is attentive to the seeming minutiae of life and the quiet moments where life happens, those moments when what might be called politics still happens but on a smaller scale, yet no less impactful on people's lives. So I wonder sometimes, like, how might we have an anarchic relationship to emotional labor or doing laundry or food preparation. All of these realms of life are open to anarchic revision. So it seems to me that it is imperative for anarchism to be larger than the go-to sites of anarchism's past and present.
Well, that's a great way to get into our next question. Throughout the text, you mentioned how both Black queer and trans feminisms have been a key influence. Can you get into talking more about this and kind of map out how these ideas influence the work that you're putting out here in Anarcho-Blackness?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've had to be super clear about this, as this has often been the part of my argument many have been most unfamiliar with. So Black feminism as a part of Black anarchism is a necessary engagement with anarcho-feminism. So historically, those who recall anarcho-feminists have insisted on the gendered nature of capitalism and power. And they noted that while sometimes the anarchist heavy hitters would concede that patriarchy is linked to class, there also needed to be a deeper and more robust understanding that experiences under capitalism are differentiated and inflected by gender. Because traditionally, anarchism relegated revolutionary and anarchic work to the public sphere as if the waged workplace was the only place work and labor was being done and from which people needed to be liberated. So anarcho-feminists have insisted that that the family and the domestic sphere are also sites of valid anarchist conflict. So that's a snapshot of anarcho-feminism. But even in this critique of anarchism, this gendered feminist critique of anarchism, you have the implicit assumption that all women occupy the unwaged domestic workplace, not to mention assumption of what or who a woman is. But the assumption of women being in the domestic sphere almost entirely failed to consider how Black women in particular had a very estranged relationship to this kind of simplistic differentiation between workplace and home life, namely because Black women often worked in other people's homes, usually for white women, historically at least. And I bring in here then the Black feminism of people like those of the Combahee River Collective and what they write in their famous Black feminist statement. Now, they don't call themselves anarchists, but rather socialists. But I'm curious about how it seems like their socialism pushes someone like Marx and essentially via that Black feminism anarchizes Marx in socialism. So if anarchists hold that until all are free, no one is free, we can then note the very express anarchism of the Combahee River Collective when they argue that, and this is like one of their most famous quotes, that if Black women were free, it would mean that everyone else would have to be free since Black women's freedom would necessitate the destruction of all systems of oppression. And this makes an honest manifestation of anarchist politics have to grapple with and have as foundational to it Black feminism. And this is written about beautifully by someone like Saidiya Hartman in her recent book, Wayward Lives and Beautiful Experiments. So I would highly recommend folks look at that, and grapple with and engage what she calls the anarchy of colored girls. So in terms of queer and trans feminism, I make note in the book of a group like the Horrid Dyke Black Trans Feminist Network. I think I got all those words in the right order. And they insist on dynamiting the gender binary as itself a political practice, because by exploding the sex and gender binary, we reject distinctions between the purported naturalness of sex and the purported culturalness of gender. So Black and trans feminist anarchism, for me, does not abide such claims and insists on noting the externally imposed coercive construction of sex as well as gender. So the sex and gender binary then are authoritative, coercive, hierarchized, and positioned that in anarchist fashion ought to be decimated. Because how we're gendered is a product of how the state and its various apparatuses seek to discipline and produce, to coerce and hierarchize different desires and bodies and ways of moving in the world. There's then a political and ethical interest in the question of gender, which becomes anarchically pertinent when viewing it as not an unmediated natural phenomenon, but a historical production that serves the interests of the state. And those who are anarchically concerned with gender argue that gender as binaristically construed and constructed rests at the heart of society's structure, because binary gender is regulated by law, by institutions, religion, medicine, and various other social authorities. So a radical departure from the state then necessitates a radical departure from compulsory binary genders. And that's how I'm bringing in, as constitutive of Black anarchism, Black feminism, and trans feminism.
In the first chapter, you bring up the concept of the undercommons. This is something I've heard a couple times. There was also wasn't there a conference or something recently?
There was. Yes, there was. There was. Yes.
Can you talk about what this means to people that maybe not be familiar with this term?
Oh, for sure. So The undercommon is something I get entirely from Fred Moten and Stefano Harney. And they both co-wrote a book together back in 2013, I believe, called The Undercommons, Fugitive Planning and Black Study. And in it, they essentially note that the undercommons is not necessarily a place or a location, but a certain mood or groove or mode of living sociality. And it's inhabited or mobilized by those committed to refusing the recognition and acknowledgement of the state, by those who do not simply seek to get rid of particular troubles, but the very world that generated the possibility of those troubles. And Moten and Harney, they also link the undercommon and those who do its work to a literal and proverbial criminality. So to do life in or through the undercommons is to quite literally steal knowledge and resources from the commons and distribute it to those barred from institutions in service of the undermining and subversion of those very institutions that make up the commons. So the undercommons is a certain kind of leaning or relationality. It's a maroon community that promotes illegally gotten resources because the legality of the law is itself violent, or that promotes an irreverence toward the hegemony of the gender binary or capitalism or white supremacy, because insofar as those systems mitigate life chances and disallow life, to undermine them is to proliferate and expand life and livelihood. But I highly, highly recommend folks read Moten and Harney's book, which is freely available online, by the way, and specifically reading the chapters entitled The University of the Undercommon, as well as Jack Halberstam's introduction to the book. But yeah, the undercommon is a concept that is growing a little bit pervasive now, precisely because it is a way to think about the radicality that a lot of people are calling for in the present time.
Trying to feed my family.
D-Mark got the ease.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Crazy, I'm getting blazing. I'm just trying to feed my family. And they sing so fast. He took a talented guy. Hope he bring back to my family tree. Ooh, why we gotta die? Why we gotta leave so early? The police killing us. Blood, I ain't racist to me. All lies matter. Give me a war. I come to the booth and I just record. Boy, you know you were wrong when you ignored George Floyd. Now we purging. Binge on my heart and it's getting extra Lord. They probably thought we forgot to take on fighting, boy. Never money up on my mind, it's all my cannon, boy. Trying to feed my family. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Crazy, I'm getting blazing. I'm just trying to feed my family. And they sing so fast. He took a talented guy. Hope he bring back to my family tree. Ooh, yeah.
Why we gotta die? Police already. Police killing us. I ain't raising to me. All lies matter. Yeah.
Trying to feed my family. Let's not forget about that youngin' with his hood on. He ain't have his hood on, but he shot him cause his hood on. I'm to my Trayvon. And they gon' respect us 9 later. Keep taking us down, let's not forget about Anderson Taylor. Money, root of all evil. And long as they gon' print it, I'ma get it for my people. More money, more problem, that's something I can't avoid. Trying to feed my family. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Crazy, I'm getting blazing. I'm just trying to feed my family. And they sing so fast. He took a talented guy. Hope he bring back to my family tree.
Ooh, yeah. Why we gotta die? Police already. Police killing us. I ain't racing to me. All lies matter. Yeah, yeah. Boy, I come to the booth and I just record.
Trying to feed my family.
I'm just trying to feed my family.
In one of the later chapters, you talk about the role of abolitionist thought in the construction of these wider concepts. I'm just curious if you can talk about that.
Oh, absolutely. So I see a firm link between abolition and anarchism, both historically and philosophically, I guess. So historically, many of the classical anarchists were deeply skeptical of prisons. And on the whole, they asserted the absolute eradication of any kind of hierarchical, governmental, coercive, or punitive system, and that necessarily extends to a site like prisons and the general notion of carcerality. And actually, Emma Goldman, in particular, was pretty fierce regarding prison and is quoted as saying something to the effect of, prisons are in no way a social protection. You might as well say that health can be promoted by a widespread contagion. So anarchists were all essentially like, F the police, the president, the boss, CEO, capitalism, prison, all of that. That is very much the kind of the legacy that anarchism leaves for us. And because of this, anarcho-blackness must be abolitionist because it also seeks the eradication of hierarchies and authoritative impositions and circumscriptions of social life. And anarcho-blackness calls for a radically new world, a world that makes impossible the very existence of things like prison. So if abolition is defined not as simply the elimination of specific prisons, but rather the instantiation of a society predicated on the very impossibility of having prisons or slave labor or wage labor, then anarcho-blackness and abolition are kind of holding hands or are best friends in the struggle for the founding of a new and different or alternative society, a new and alternative way of living with others and on the earth. And that to me is abolition kind of par excellence.
As discussion of abolitionist ideas like enters more into the mainstream and there's, there seems to be a discussion more and more about defunding the police and kind of there's I don't know. I almost feel like sometimes these ideas are kind of like as they enter more into the mainstream, they almost kind of get diluted. I'm just kind of curious.
Yes.
What is your current kind of feeling about just the conversation around that? Because when it first started, it seemed like, oh wow, this is really awesome. And at this point now, it's like, oh, we're talking about defunding a police department, even especially at a time when like. The pandemic has caused like such shortfalls and like, tax revenue that, I mean, a lot of this stuff is going to happen anyway. I don't know. In some cities, it seems to be happening. Like I know in Seattle, they're like defunding the police supposedly by half of their budget. So it'll be interesting to see kind of what happens with that. In Minneapolis, the city council supposedly says they're going to abolish the police, but I guess that remains to be seen. And I guess the other question too is that like, what would it also mean for, like a city government to quote unquote abolish the police, but yet there still be a state?
Yeah, that's wonderful, wonderful question. So it's always vexing for me when various terms that are promoted via radical movements are entered into the mainstream, because as you said, they get diluted, very much so. In order to enter the mainstream, they must be diluted, which is frustrating to me. So there was a lot of talk between or about defunding the police, which is not at all the same as abolishing the police. Sometimes folks conflated the two. They are not the same by any means. Because defunding the police, we might say, though I don't know if I want to commit to this, but we might say that defunding the police is a kind of reform of law enforcement. And as we know from Angela Davis, reform is constitutive of the various ways that law enforcement, that prison, that carcerality, that various kinds of injustices and oppressions and hegemonies are kind of made stronger in some way. They're just made more adept at getting around certain kinds of pushback. So I'm very, very skeptical of the simplistic ways that the conversation surrounding defunding the police is bandied about. But yes, there's a very much a kind of dilution of the radical edges of these various terms and movements when they enter into the mainstream. And I don't know, I guess I'm still hopeful in some ways because the conversation is happening nonetheless, but still there is a way that I need there to be more. I need a different way of approaching these conversations that does not defang them in a sense. And as you noted, what does it mean to abolish the police when the state is still exists? Because we must very well note that the state is itself an arm of or a disseminator of violence and enforcement and circumscription and all that kind of stuff. So to defund the the literal law enforcement wing does not abolish or get rid of the enforcement of laws, which is necessarily the enforcement or necessarily the use of violence in order to enforce these things. So if we're going to abolish the police, we also must necessarily abolish the state, because if the urge or the thing propelling us to abolish the police is to mitigate violence, then we absolutely 100% need to also then think about and follow through on abolishing the state, precisely because the state is the primary progenitor of that violence.
Yeah, just to kind of continue on with that, I mean, as a lot of people have put forward, you know, for instance, if quote, the police were abolished, but yet we had a regime of, I don't know, social workers or other types of kind of like societal managers in place that like basically took on the role of the police. Like, what would that look like, especially with all of the gendered, racialized, you know, class-based systems in place that would create perhaps, you know, new realities for people that they'd have to live through?
Exactly. And that's also there's a parallel there too between, this is not the exact same thing, so I don't want to promote an analogical relationship to this, but there's a parallel in, say, the abolition of U.S. enslavement, for example, of plantation slavery. That then did not mean that it all went away, but it was then reformulated, as so many people have detailed, as detailed in the documentary 13th, as detailed by Angela Davis, as detailed by Douglas Blackman and Beth Ritchie, all these people who are noting that how the system of hyper-racialized mass incarceration is in many ways a continuation of, say, vagrancy laws and Jim Crow, which is then a continuation of the system of U.S. plantation enslavement. So all these things, if we are abolishing one thing, that does not mean that there are not other things that will take its place and do similar, if not the same, kind of work. So we must absolutely always be vigilant about those things as well. And the way that history has manifested and taught us things, we must heed those lessons.
I'm just curious, you know, on the topic of the recent rebellion, has that changed anything in terms of your worldview or only solidified your ideas? I'm just curious if that's kind of, interjected anything.
Yeah. So this is a great question. One that I kept thinking about it, mulling it over. So I've long recognized the pervasive anti-blackness of, in particular, the U.S. And I've long understood that what we're seeing now in terms of rebellions and protests and general agitation is part of a very long lineage and is nothing particularly new. So in that sense, little in terms of my thinking or understanding of the world has changed, because there's been little new input. But I will say that the contemporary moment has had an affective toll on me. It's hit me in a way that is new. And part of it is because I'm trying more to feel with my comrades in the struggle. And part of it is because I'm now living in Chicago and I'm closer to and more materially affected by, specific protests. And I think part of it also, lastly, is because I'm paying more attention. So perhaps I don't think all that much differently, but I 100% certainly feel differently about how things are going now. I'm having a much more affective and emotional kind of stake in these things, and that's affected me in a very visceral way.
Just to kind of follow up on that, I'm just curious your thoughts on, you know, in the aftermath of the rebellion, for instance, like you could turn on Netflix and it would have like a Black Lives Matter section that you could watch. And I mean, I don't know if you saw the recent interview with Trump on Axios. That was pretty, you know, just a, you know, bumbling disaster. But I mean, you know, he again said, you know, I've done more for Black people than any other president since Lincoln. And, you know, I'm so great and stuff. So it seems, you know, all these different factions and forces within capitalism and the state are trying to kind of position themselves like in the aftermath of this as, you know, advocates for Black people. And I'm just curious, you know, your thoughts on this. I mean, like, this thing is obviously not done and, you know, this is not be the last uprising we see, obviously, but I'm just curious, kind of like in the wake of this, what are your thoughts seeing these different players, articulate whatever they're saying?
Yeah, I'm going to purposely keep this response short because I can just go on about this, but it is wild to me how deftly capitalism can co-opt and absorb various kinds of radical movements and make them palatable and commodified by capitalist consumption. It is astounding to me and also quite disheartening to me at the same time, I suppose. And that's, I don't know, we very much have to be, like, when it's possible that someone like Trump or a site like a billion-dollar site like Facebook or all these various kinds of institutions that very much expel or very much exude capitalist ethos, then we need to be quite suspicious when they can do these things, when they can say these things or advocate for these things, because what does it say then that these institutions can get on board with this stuff? What had to be excised? What had to be diminished and made more palatable when these institutions can do these things? So while I'm disheartened, I'm still nevertheless kind of emboldened and given hope by various people that I know, various organizations that are still putting in the work, that have been putting in the work for years, maybe even decades. I'm given hope by those kinds of places and people. And that, I think, for me, simply lights a kind of a fire for me and makes me continue to do the work, continue to be vigilant about my own kind of biases and absorption of capitalist and state relations and all that kind of stuff. So I'm hopeful, while at the same time, it is still quite disheartening that all these various state apparatuses can get on board now that protests and rebellion seem to be profitable.
As we discussed with various guests in the past on this show, there seems to be a growing current of Black anarchist formations, books, ideas, groups. Do you hope this current grows in the near future? And if so, how?
Yeah, I do. I do hope it grows. I really do. And I hope it grows in ways that I both can and cannot anticipate, because I think my hope would be that how people latch on to Black anarchism and Black anarchist formations is through a concerted and an intentional effort to undermine violence, by which I mean, as I've said many times and as I'll say again, the state is the primary progenitor of violence. So to undermine the ways that violence and violent frameworks seep into our lives is to undermine the state, which is at base an anarchic move. Or I guess to put it differently, I'm not so caught up in Black anarchist formation being an adherence to Black people who espouse their anarchism. And I'm more interested in how folks take up the call of the Black radical tradition that someone like Cedric Robinson has deemed as a fundamental critique of Western civilization. And that I would also say posits an irreverence toward gender normativity and the hegemony of capitalism and neoliberal individualism. All of that on the one hand. And then, on the other hand, how folks take up the call of anarchism by uprooting authoritarian ideas and hierarchies and governmentality and state relations, precisely because, the state and all its, kind of violent apparatuses infuse our very relations with other people. The state is also a relation in my opinion. So we must also undermine and eradicate those things. And I want that understanding to proliferate as well. So that's my hope for the proliferation of Black anarchist formations, how people take up these calls.
I'm just curious, you know, on a personal level, somebody that's teaching, are you finding a lot of ideas and concepts coming out of academia, I guess, exciting? Is there a lot of, like, interesting work happening, like, in that field right now?
There is, yeah. I mean, I'm very much an academic, and I enjoy being an academic. And so there are a lot of cool, interesting, wonderful, radical things coming out. A lot of stuff by AK Press, and also a lot of stuff coming out of presses like Duke University Press and Minnesota Press and NYU Press. So the Kia Iman Jackson's book, Becoming Human, is something that's wonderful. Fred Moten's academic trilogy, Consent Not to Be a Single Being, is absolutely phenomenal. There's work by C. Riley Snort in his book Black on Both Sides, The Racial History of Trans Identity. What else? There's so much stuff out there that's really, really... Oh, there's the anthology Otherwise Worlds on Blackness and Indigeneity that just came out with Duke. So all these things are coming out, and so much more, so much more that I can't even name right now. That's really giving me, getting me jazzed up, getting me super excited about the kinds of ideas that are kind of trickling into the academy and that I hope will inevitably proliferate and become more pervasive in the ways that they then affect and infect sociality and how we relate to one another, how things go and all of that. So yeah, academia, for all that it entails, all the bad and good things that it entails, there's a lot of interesting work coming out, in my opinion, that I don't know, I'm hoping will get people to do things and think different things and think differently and think about all the radical stuff that so many other people have already been espousing.
Awesome. Well, let's talk about your book. Where can people get it? When is it coming out? Anything else you want to say on it?
So yeah, it's coming out, I believe, August 18th. The book is available for pre-order on AK Press's website and should ideally be purchased there. And I believe AK Press is offering a 25% off on, all pre-orders of the book too. So you can get the book there. I hope folks enjoy it. I really do.
Awesome. Yeah. And if you have like a community center or info shop, maybe get them to order it. Or go to AK Press online. Well, also, anything else you want to say? How can people follow your work? Do you have anything else coming down the pipe that you want to talk about? Anything else you want to promote?
Yeah. So I'm at work on a few different projects, but the main one is an academic book monograph that I've titled Black Trans Feminism. And that's currently under contract and should be released either late next year or early 2022. And while it's academic, it covers some, I think, necessary and important terrain in terms of thinking about Black feminism and trans feminism through abolition and what I'm calling gender radicality. And in terms of where my work can be found, most of my work can be found on my academia page at, what is the website? I think it's northwestern.academia.edu/Marquise Bay, I believe. So you can follow my work there.
Awesome. Anything else you want to say or talk about that we didn't get a chance to go over?
No, this was a very thorough and wonderful interview. Thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you so much for these incredible, wonderful, and generative questions, too. So, yeah, that's really all I have. I just have thanks for you and also the listeners, whoever might listen to this. I'm just incredibly honored and thankful for the time I had to share my thoughts on these things.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.